And we're rolling.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeehaw.
So I'm Teddy Bernard. I'm a sophomore at SAIC. I use they, them pronouns. I feel like I'm introducing myself for a Zoom class, but yeah, so that's me.
I am Elton Amadou Connell. I am also a sophomore at SAIC, and I use like they or he, mostly they. So we're here to talk about how certain bands have influenced how we dress, but also like how we think about gender stuff. And yeah.
Music and gender identity.
Music and gender identity.
Yeah, I think that was part of something when we first met. That was something where I was like, oh my God, this is really funny because both of us listened to similar music that kind of helped us figure out our gender identity and presentation in similar ways. That was like, what? Another person who kind of is on the same page as me about this. So this is kind of like a collection of those stories from both of us. Talking through how that happened, how we got to where we are now.
Yeah, I can get started and talk about my first person, unless you have anything else to add.
Yeah, I would love to hear about your first person. Please tell
Yeah,
me.
yeah. So the first person I wanted to talk about is Pete Shelley, who was the lead singer and guitarist and like songwriter for the Buzzcocks, or just Buzzcocks, I think is how they prefer it, which was like a pretty seminal early punk band in England, founded in 1976. And Pete Shelley is largely known for like writing very, very earnestly about human connection and like unrequited love. And they also wrote Orgasm Addict. And then they Buzzcocks broke up in 1981, and Pete Shelley had a solo career after that and wrote Homo Sapien, which was a very like synth poppy song about being gay that was banned by the BBC for having too explicit of a reference to gay sex, which I believe he denied, for the line "Homo superior in my interior." And so it was a big hit on the in the club circuit, and Pete Shelley was
How could it
openly
not be?
right. Yeah, it's a classic. Yeah, and he was openly bi for a very long time. Lots of rumors have it that a lot of his songs for Buzzcocks were about his bandmate Steve Diggle. Cannot confirm. And then he unfortunately died 3 years ago now in 2018. And so his like personal presentation was never really that important for me. He never really had very like flamboyant stage costumes or anything like that. But his singing voice has always been like very, very, I don't know, hit me very, very close to home, because it's very kind of like shrill at times, very audibly like at the top of his range. And it sounds like a dear friend singing along to like Ronnie Spector. I got it into Buzzcocks like pretty early in high school when I was like starting to figure out my own gender stuff. His singing voice just gave me like gender dysphoria very hard. And I don't really know why, and I don't completely understand it, but that like high singing with like high singing at like the top of a person's range always makes me feel lots of different gender things that I don't really have like good articulation of.
Any specific songs?
Really all of them. Lipstick is a great example, I think. And then Ever Fallen in Love with Somebody You Shouldn't Have Fallen in Love With is, I think, a very good example of like his songwriting. But really, like everything that I listened to of the Buzzcocks, especially when I was in high school, was off of Singles Going Steady, which is a 1978 album. Everybody's Happy Nowadays, a song off the album that is very good. But yeah, that has, I would say, a lot of their more well-known songs on it. And yeah, it was very influential for me. And it's very good for like instilling like nervous confidence. It's good to listen to when you're walking around and like on public transit. They've been like the Buzzcocks and Pete Shelley in particular, and like his singing have definitely been very influential on bands since then. So yeah, I'm sure it was influence on other stuff that I'm gonna talk about later. Yeah, I'll turn it over to you, Teddy.
Okay, well, thank you for sharing that. That
Yeah.
was very cool. I didn't know very much about Pete Shelley, so I appreciate that.
Yeah,
I feel like I got a pretty comprehensive look. I'm going to be talking a little bit about Japan, the band, not the country, which I feel very unfortunate in doing so because I have complicated feelings about them as a band, but it's undeniable the influence they had on me as a young genderqueer kid, so I'm just going to do it. They were a glam rock, then into new wave band from the late 70s, early 80s. They were very stylish. They were kind of a gateway drug into glam rock in general for me, so that's kind of how I ended up getting into New York Dolls, T-Rex, that whole scene. You know, in the 70s, they had that very kind of stereotypical glam look, giant hair, too much makeup, outfits that just were terrible, but it was very androgynous in a way that was an overperformance of both masculinity and femininity that I hadn't really seen before. And I was really into the idea that androgyny wasn't just like trying to reduce as much gender expression as possible, but instead try to overperform gender on both sides of the spectrum. And so that was super interesting to me. A little bit about the band's history. They formed with three initial members, which was brothers Stephen Batt and David Batt and their friend from high school,
Andonis Michaelides.
The three of them later took on stage names, that being Steve Jansen, David Sylvian, and Mick Karn, respectively, two of those names being taken as pseudo references to the New York Dolls. So then their other school friend, Richard Barbieri, was added to the band, and a guitarist, Rob Dean. They were eventually contracted by Simon Napier Bell, who had also been the manager of T-Rex, and so they became a band. You know, David Sylvian was pretty inspirational to me in high school. I tried to look like him a lot. You know, very much trying to do the sort of overperforming of both feminine and masculine qualities, right? Wearing these very tight suits, but also giant hair and lots of lip gloss, which was something they kept from the 70s into the 80s in a way that a lot of 80s bands kind of started to fade into, let's wear less makeup. They were still doing full blush, even when they were kind of having those suit and tie looks. I guess another thing that's slightly notable about Japan is I was very much into reading band interviews at the time, and there was an interview with one of the members, Steve, in which he says that he didn't feel like a man or a woman. And I remember at the time I was like, oh, sick, me neither. Like, I can connect to this person who I look up to. He went back on that statement a few years ago on a blog where essentially someone asked him, like, hey, can you clarify what you meant here? And he was like, oh, I just, that's just something I said because I was tired of the interviewer asking me all of these silly questions, but not in a way that I think necessarily puts down genderqueer people when he went into that. Anyways, I still think that was an important moment for me because I didn't have the full context of that, and just thinking about the fact that they weren't considering themselves, at least actively feeling in a gender way. So that was important to me. I was very influenced by Japan for a long time, and then from that got into glam rock a lot, right? New York Dolls, who were also very much overperforming femininity and masculinity in very weird ways. And also, kind of on to the next thing that we wanted to talk about, T-Rex, who I think we both have feelings about, right?
Yeah, definitely.
T-Rex, about them. Before becoming T-Rex, Mark Bolan was the frontman of Tyrannosaurus Rex, a 60s psychedelic folk band with fellow bandmate Steve Perrigan-Took. Ultimately, Steve Perrigan-Took left the band, and Mickey Finn was invited to join the band, and the band was renamed T-Rex. So they started moving into the direction of rock, building kind of the fundamentals of the glam rock genre. The band expanded to include other instrumentalists as well as backing vocals from a few musicians, notably Gloria Jones. As T-Rex, they released 8 albums from 1970 to 1977 before Bolan's untimely death. Including Tyrannosaurus Rex albums, they released 12 albums from 1968 to 1977, which is a truly astounding amount of music. I would say probably the most notable T-Rex album is Electric Warrior. And now I'm going to open the floor to just talking about them. Elton, yeah. Opinions, thoughts?
Definitely. Yeah, well, Mark Bolan singing definitely has like a similar place in my heart to Pete Shelley singing. It's a little bit more like comfortable sounding. For me, I really love T-Rex and Mark Bolan, because for me, it feels like he kind of is not like outside of gender and sex norms or like the like current constructs, but like prior to it, it feels like he's operating from this like primordial pit of pure vibes. And yeah, like even when he's singing about having sex with women, it doesn't really feel super straight.
Yeah, I actually made a note about this. There's some men who sing about their love of women and their masculinity, and then it like it's hard for me to necessarily identify as that as someone who's not a cis man. But when it's for Mark Bolan, it's different. There's something about it that's distinctly different, that's distinctly kind of queer in the way that he just speaks about his love. It's more about the essence of love and less about the physicality of it. I don't know if that you would agree with that, but
yeah,
not,
I don't know.
Not that there aren't some sexy vibes going on, but it's,
I think, yeah, it's definitely horny, but it never feels like it's tied up in anything he's trying to project about himself.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's usually, I think a lot of the times it is like very horny, but it's usually just like horniness for the person. And there's not the like kind of like, I mean, especially like if we're talking about like 70s bands, a lot of mm-hmm. it is very like conquest-y.
Mm-hmm.
Not
that it maybe like, doesn't have a few moments of being 70s band-esque, but
oh,
like,
for sure, it definitely does. Yeah, but I think he's getting like he's being conquered as much as he's conquering, I think.
Oh, definitely.
You know what I mean? It's
yeah. I also think part of the thing that's interesting about the way T-Rex is horny, which this has gotten in a weird discussion, but I'm gonna go there. Part of the reason of what makes T-Rex's horniness interesting is he can write a song that's super horny without mentioning sex once. It can be about like magical fairy elf wizards and you're like, why is this song so horny? You're literally not talking about like touching or kissing anyone, and it's just like the vibe is just so, I don't know,
just yeah,
he's able to exert vibes without saying it.
Yeah, it's always feels very like it's coming from like a gut instinct kind of thing and not super structured or like super conscious of like, not that it's like he's not thinking about what he's writing, but like, you know what I mean? It feels very like stream mm-hmm. of consciousness often. Yeah, I wanted to, this might be kind of a tangent, but I wanted to read some like quotes that I had saved mm-hmm. from an interview.
Oh, this is not
with Jan Illis. I'm probably mispronouncing this person's name, but somebody at the Pop and Record Swap Mirror, that was an interview from 1975. So the interview asked, are you heterosexual? And Mark Bolan said, no, bisexual, but I believe I'm more heterosexual because I definitely like boobs. I've always wished I was 100% gay. It's much easier. And then the interviewer followed up with, yeah, but not much fun, eh? And he said, that's true because you have the best of both worlds. But I think if you're gay or whatever, you have just so much fun. Anyway, as I said, I've checked it all out and I prefer chicks.
It's amazing. It's just an amazing interview clip. I mean, I was not aware at all that he was bisexual until a few months ago, which I've been into the band for maybe a year and a half. And when I get into bands, I get really into bands. I read interviews, all of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And I wasn't necessarily shocked to find out he was bisexual, just because I do think there's a certain aura you get from his music that you're like, okay. But at the same time, I was like, oh, okay, that's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, I think especially like in this era and this genre in particular, there's a lot of kind of outward posing and kind of like suggesting that you might be not 1000% straight and like straight-laced kind of thing without a lot of like always internal stuff or like talk to back it up, like with David Bowie.
Mm-hmm.
Not to get into that whole can mm-hmm. of worms, but I always think of definitely his public image benefited a lot from kind of a lot of like outward expression of androgyny that he later in life like went back on for the most part. And yeah, I was thinking about that with what you said with Japan too, like with that interview that even though like they like later like gave more context that it wasn't really mm-hmm. it wasn't really like exactly like they weren't speaking to how they felt exactly. But yeah, I feel like it's kind of rare to see performers from this era who were kind of like outwardly, you know, kind of like limp-wristed and like doing stuff.
Yeah.
Actually talk about it.
And standing by it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a few other circumstances with Japan too, of people suggesting or implying that and then going back on it later with sexuality and whatnot, which again, it gets to a point where it's like, were you again just trying to further a career in public image and then going back on it when homophobia was becoming more rampant and biphobia, which that's an entirely different podcast episode.
The whole, yeah, I think especially, you know, if somebody's in the public eye and considering like the very, very conservative turn that the 80s took, not to say that there wasn't conservatism in the 70s, but mm-hmm. I feel like it's hard to draw a super clean line between talking about something and then going back on it for publicity purposes versus personal safety or not having the time or space to like really work something out and it being safer to just be like, nope.
Yeah.
Yeah. And especially language and what it means has, I mean, changed so much in the past like several decades, but like in general.
Right. Just kind of on another note about T-Rex and gender, just to kind of conclude this little part of the thing. I related to what you said earlier about Mark Bolan's voice. I think the way he styles his voice and the way he sings is something that definitely has given me not only like gender envy, but also while singing with him, I feel like I'm able to project a kind of masculinity that I'm able to envision for myself more than other kind of projections of masculinity. Again, not to say that it necessarily is masculinity. I wrote this in my notes debating whether it's feminine masculinity or non-toxic or not masculinity at all. I think it's not really something you can label, especially with a band like T-Rex, where it didn't really feel like anyone in the band was necessarily trying to form those boundaries or lines, right? Which is part of what makes them so good.
Yeah. Yeah, it doesn't really feel like something that has to be, like, categorized in a super firm way, which is, mm-hmm. yeah, mm-hmm. rad.
Not even just their musical stylings, but also the fashion sense, which is ridiculous. Oh, my God.
Yeah, definitely.
Any last thoughts on T-Rex?
Not really. I think we've kind of covered all of it. Yeah, I can go into talking about Brian Molko.
Yes, please do.
Kind of a time leap. So
yeah, what era are we in now? Fill us in.
We are now in like the late 90s. Kind of far ahead, but something worth noting. So Brian Molko was the vocalist and guitarist and co-songwriter in Placebo, which he founded with bassist and guitarist Stefan Ozdahl in 1994. And they have had three drummers and I'm sure more touring. Brian Molko and Stefan Ozdahl are kind of like the core members. And they actually starred as an unnamed analog for T-Rex, I would argue, in just kind of visually a similar band to T-Rex in Velvet Goldmine, which is a 1998 film by Todd Haynes, which was essentially a unauthorized David Bowie biopic. So it's has many, many characters based off of key players in this era of like British glam and glam adjacent music. They do a cover of 20th Century Boy.
Okay. Yeah. So then, yeah, literally T-Rex parallels.
Yeah, yeah. So, and I think that's the only, I believe that's the only T-Rex song in the movie. And Brian Molko is like top hatted, I think, throughout. The whole band at that period is in the movie, I think, with another person. But anyway, yeah, so they were in this movie that came out at kind of like a peak moment in their career about these bands. And they also, again, like, I'm not really gonna get into David Bowie, but they did at points like work fairly closely with him and I think toured with him at one point. Mm-hmm. And I think he's somebody that Brian Molko cites as an influence often. Mm-hmm. Definitely being influenced by T-Rex and all the bands that surrounded them. Placebo is kind of like a screechy kind of like, I want to say gothy, but I don't know. I'm honestly not sure if that is even an accurate word to use. The fans are definitely gothy. Mm-hmm. I would say like largely like a reaction to Britpop in that era. especially at the time, a lot of the coverage was comparing them to that or like contrasting them to that. And so lots of their music is about sex and drugs and mental illness. Brian Molko was very much, in particular in the 90s, he's kind of gotten less androgynous in his stage appearance in more recent years, but was very known for being very androgynous, if not just overtly feminine on stage, wore makeup lots most of the time, and wore dresses pretty frequently, and had a range of haircuts, a wide range of haircuts, varying in successfulness, especially in early years, had a very like distinctive middle part black bob that mm-hmm. was very androgynous and very influential to me in high school. And I had that haircut for many years. Yeah, so was like very much known for being like outwardly androgynous, and also had a very like, has a very like nasal high-pitched singing voice. In a Kerrang interview from 2006, he said about Blister in the Sun by the Violent Femmes, he said, "I was listening to this when I first realized I could sing. I put it on in my mom's car on the way back, on the way home from the supermarket when I was 13, and I was singing along to it. When I was 13, my voice sounded exactly like Gordon Gano's." I would say I kind of had a similar moment with Placebo, not with like realizing that I could sing, because I still can't, but I would say played like a key role in a moment I had very early on in like realizing that I was trans, and this is like when I was probably like 15, and realizing kind of how, at least at that point, how difficult it was to get hormones if you were non-binary, and especially like if you were not prepared to like present a very like firm front of like how cis doctors expect trans mass people to be. My understanding was that it was like almost impossible to get hormones if you were non-binary, unless you paid out of pocket for it and just did informed consent. So I at that point, that was like something that I really wanted to do, which I am on hormones now, but got on like a year ago. But so that was like something that I, at the time, like felt would be very helpful. And so, and especially would be helpful in not being read as like a woman in public, mm-hmm. which I didn't particularly want to be read as a man, but I didn't enjoy being read as a woman. And so I kind of came to this realization of like, oh, I'm not really going to be able to like pass in any kind of way anytime soon. And so I just resolved to like be really obnoxious and confusing as much as possible. And in particular, I found this like way of being like feminine in a very obnoxious and uninviting way that was very influenced by Brian Molko, and that he kind of led me to, because he was, you know, in the 90s was very like fairly feminine, but also super angry and like cranky and yelling about stuff and like playing loud guitar riffs. And so he really like helped me come to that, and yeah, like helped me find like this like antagonistic kind of version of androgyny that felt very like achievable for me, that wasn't trying to pass as anything, but just, I don't know, try to avert people's eyes away from you or punish people for trying to interrogate your appearance. Yeah, that was very, very influential for me at that age, and for, you know, several years in high school, not several years, because that's not how time works, but long period in high school where I would like put eyeliner on at night so I could wake up with it all smeary to look like Brian Molko. If it's all right, I'll read a quote from an interview from 2017, The Independent, interviewed by Rumfrey Deadman. So this is Brian Molko talking about how he dressed. "I wanted to challenge the homophobia that I was witnessing in the music scene. I wanted anybody who was slightly homophobic to show up at our gigs and think, oh, I really fancy the singer, she's hot, only to find out later that the singer was called Brian, which would hopefully lead them to go home and ask themselves a few questions. Of course, the cross-dressing was an aesthetic choice, but for us, it was also a political act." I think I encountered that interview quote in high school, but just that philosophy of dressing in a way that makes you feel good, but also is designed to be kind of antagonistic to the people around you was very, yeah, very much impressed on me. And yeah, like felt achievable in a way that like the kind of traditional is not quite the right word, but the kind of like you were talking about, like the very like kind of neutered lack of gender expression, kind of androgyny that like, I think especially when like when I was younger was like kind of the only like way that I saw like represented to be androgynous, and then not that frequently.
Yep.
So yeah, it was very major for me with Placebo. I mean, like Nancy Boy, kind of obvious. I mean, that was kind of, I think, one of their like biggest early hits, where they like don't really like, they, I think they won't play it live anymore. That's, I mean, that song is, and also like Burger Queen was one that like,
right,
yeah, really resonated for me at that age. And I will say, I think for me being the fondness that I have for Placebo comes as much from gender stuff as it does from just like being emo.
yeah there's overlap. It's not just the gender stuff, there's other reasons.
Yeah most definitely. That's kind of all I can say about Brian Molko. Also somebody who has been very openly bi for I think basically his whole career, and Stefan Ozdahl, who he founded the band with, is gay. I think he's been pretty openly gay for a while. So yeah,
that's fantastic.
Thank you.
I guess I'm gonna talk about the Human League.
You.
So the Human League, they're an 80s band. They initially formed with four members, but the four split into two. Two of them went on to form Heaven 17, and the other two, Phil Oakey and Adrian Wright, went on to form the Human League, or continue the Human League, I should say. They added in a variety of members across the years. The three most notable members and the current lineup is essentially Phil Oakey, Susan Ann Sully, and Joanne Catherall. And so they're kind of the three singers, the three main members. In the 80s, the most iconic lineup would have been the three of them, Adrian Wright, Ian Burden, and Joe Callis. They were the lineup that released the album Dare and the album Hysteria, which Dare is the album Don't You Want This On, which of course everyone knows them for and everyone cares about very much because working as a waitress in a cocktail bar. So the thing that is important to me about the Human League, besides the fact that they were a band that I got into pretty early on, and so, you know, that is important, but it's maybe not at all about their music as much about one certain music video that changed a lot of my ideas about gender and presentation at the time I saw it, and that was the video for Keep Feeling Fascination. I'll give a little description of the video for people who haven't seen it. Essentially, there's a giant red building, and you zoom in on the building, and all of the members are in there playing fake instruments and wearing these black outfits in this monochrome gray room. So, you know, the girls are in dresses, Phil's in this suit, the other guys are kind of in leather jackets or whatever shirt they picked off their bedroom floor. And, you know, I hadn't been exposed to many examples of androgyny or gender nonconformingness at all at this age. And so I watched this video and it zooms in on the band and no one has started singing yet. And Phil, Susan, and Joanne all have the exact same makeup in a way that made me a very naive, like, 14 or 15 year old who hadn't really like seen someone presenting in a way that wasn't just standard think, oh, they're all three women. But then Phil opens his voice and sings in this kind of wonderful baritone, and it's like, oh no, that's not what's going on here at all. And it was really exciting for me. I think part of what was exciting was that I was hit with the realization that someone could wear makeup and not be a woman. And I had a really hard time even approaching the idea of makeup until then, because I associated it so deeply with womanhood and femininity. And I wasn't interested in those things, and I didn't want people to think I was interested in those things. And so I remember watching this video and being like, oh, I can wear makeup and not be a woman, or even necessarily be interpreted as female, I guess. And so I after I watched that video, I immediately ran to my room. I pulled out my outfit that was like closest to the outfit he's wearing in the video, which was this like terrible brown blazer and like pajama shirt, and did makeup for like the first time in my life. There's this photo of me I took there. My hair is like poorly slicked back and I have this not very good makeup on, but it was so exciting to me at the time. I still thought I was cis. I thought I was cis for a few months after that, but I knew that I wanted what?
Oh, sorry. That's not very long.
Yeah. Well, not very long, but also considering the fact that I was like, I don't want to be seen or thought of as a woman, but I want to do makeup, and still thought I was cis, is just interesting. But that's another thing about all of the members of the Human League, is their fashion sense was very much kind of across the board, bulky jewelry, colorful outfits, you know, skirts, makeup, for all of the members, really. Ian Burden and Adrian Wright, not so much, but Joanne, Susan, Phil, and Joe all kind of experimented with fashion and femininity and androgyny in a way that was pretty influential to me at the time. I have a quote, actually, from an article called Human League, New Romantics, Rightful Heirs by Jenny Valentinish. And I feel like this kind of talks about their aesthetic, so here's the quote. Oki's old aesthetic, asymmetrical haircut, makeup, diamante earrings, owed more to Brian Eno's and showbiz than gender politics, but he does note that he and his peers were pro-equality on every front. Then there's a quote from Oki. The last guy we had playing guitar had a very androgynous look, and we went out one night and some people started throwing punches at him, he says. I thought we would beaten that. Just kind of a depressing quote to include now that I'm thinking about it, but I like that because it kind of, you know, reflects how the band was doing it, maybe just for style, but then it ended up kind of influencing how they thought about each other and gender and that sort of stuff. So yeah, and I love the Human League. They're cheesy and whatnot, but I really feel like without Phil Oki, I would maybe not still, not that I do wear makeup, but I would maybe still be like, I'm not gonna do that. That's not for me, a person who just doesn't want to be seen as female, but is definitely cis. So thanks, right. Phil. I figured some shit out. It's really impactful for me on a kind of understanding of not only gender presentation, but my ability to reformat the way I thought about presenting myself. That's kind of my rant about them.
Yeah, thank you. Mm-hmm. After I got dumped for the first time, I got real into Depeche Mode.
What a transition.
Right? Thank you.
Obsessed. Okay.
So let's talk about them.
I would love to.
Yeah, so
I'd love to discuss Depeche Mode. Do you have a little band history about Depeche Mode?
I have a little band history to talk about right now.
Fantastic.
Yeah, so Depeche Mode was named after Dave Gahan saw a French fashion magazine. It means like fashion dispatch or like fashion update.
Fast fashion.
Yeah, fast fashion. Yeah, I think you're right. Mm-hmm. But
Depeche means like quickly or fast or something like that.
You're right. You're right, you got me.
I just took like two levels of French. It's okay.
That's good for you. Yeah, but so they were formed in 1980 with Martin Gore and Dave Gahan and Vince Clark and Andy Fletcher. Vince Clark left in 1981, and then they were joined by Alan Wilder, who then left in 1995. They were kind of pioneers in like electronic music, I would say. Mm-hmm. And yeah, put out a lot of fucking albums, and are still together and putting out new music. I think just with Martin Gore and Dave Gahan and Andy Fletcher now, but have put out new albums fairly recently.
Where's the revolution?
Yeah, thank you. And have had a very great confrontation with alt-right people who I'm not gonna put my energy towards trying to remember who, but somebody said that Depeche Mode was the official music of the alt-right, and they very harshly repudiated it in the media, as they should. And
well, I think the music that was video for Where's the Revolution is literally dressed up as
Karl Marx. Yeah.
Karl Marx. And
I would say also like pioneers in like singing about BDSM.
Yep.
I mean, I don't think I really need to say like how influential Depeche Mode has been. All the background information I have. Do you have anything that you want to add?
About Depeche Mode's band history?
Yeah.
I think the only notable thing might be to mention that very early on when they formed, they still had that kind of like kind of family-friendly, new wavy, poppy sound, right? Hey, you're such a pretty boy. Right. And then Vince Clark left and they dropped that and got very dark very quickly. So I think that's maybe the one thing I would include, is just the fact that they did have a phase briefly that was very, a little generic, and then just immediately pivoted from that in a way that really has shaped music, as you talked about.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And I think it's probably also worth mentioning that like they've kind of always been like to some degree like pop darlings in England, which is like not really how they're perceived here, I would say. Yeah, their first album is definitely a very, very different vibe. But also, yeah, like the song that you like quoted from, is it just called What's Your Name?
I think so.
Yeah, off of Speak and Spell, right? Yeah, I think that still is popular with gays. I know it was covered by Pansy Division in the 90s or like the early 2000s.
Mm-hmm. I mean, that's the other thing too, is I feel like their first album, despite the fact that it's very different, a lot of people who really like their darker stuff, for lack of a better word, still also enjoy that. And I do think the foundations for the sound they took on are there. It's just kind of funny to listen to the musical difference.
Yeah, you can definitely see the like the roots, but it is a different vibe. Yeah. I'll open with this quote from Dave Gahan in an interview with Johnny Davis for The Guardian from 2007. He said, "We used to look pretty gay. It wasn't so much the mini skirt over the leather pants with boots. That had a punky thing about it. But when Martin wore the full-length maxi with the cowboy hat, that was beyond gay." So, yeah, Martin Gore's fashions were pretty influential for me figuring out how to be androgynous as a young person who is still very weird-looking.
Yeah, I would definitely say that's something about Martin Gore's looks, is he champions the androgyny that's so confusing that even though I'm weird looking, it's kind of hot. That's definitely
he is a hero of the like weird looking horny person.
yes.
Yeah,
I mean that's the definitely their look has a very androgynous feel to it. I mean obviously Martin's, but the other band members as well, I would argue. Yeah,
for sure.
Some of Dave's styles and looks throughout the years, even if they're just kind of no one was as extreme as Martin in any given circumstance about anything. I think we can all agree on that. But certainly there's lots of fashion adventures they've gotten up to across the years.
Yeah, most definitely. But yeah, I really enjoyed it, how it felt very like real. That's kind of a weak word to use, but never felt like sterile or like kind of like weird and editorial and like careful or like, yeah, it's just like their androgyny was always kind of messy, again, like I think kind of awkward looking often, in a way that made it feel like a real person.
Yeah. No, I like what you just said, like it didn't feel editorial or sterile, because I feel like you kind of also talked about this before with kind of thinking about when you're experiencing kind of getting into Brian Molko's stuff and his looks and whatnot, is just the idea that it's not the kind of androgyny you had seen, which was not very much, but was again the kind of like, yeah, editorial and sterilized, like this is very much just like, we are combining a little bit feminine, a little bit masculine, toning them both down, and this is an androgynous person. Like, that's what's happening. They're like, Martin Gore's like, yeah, I just found a bunch of flapper pearls, and I'm gonna put them on with this weird dress and then grab a giant hammer, and that's androgyny.
Yeah.
Like, okay, great.
And I think, I think it's a lot more similar to how the non-binary and gender non-conforming people I know now dress.
Yeah.
Which is usually much louder and weirder and goofier than the, like, I think what we're probably both, like, coming from, which is that, like, kind of mid-2010s, like, usually, like, white, thin, conventionally attractive,
shaved head,
like, trans mask person. And that were, and yeah, like, short hair or, like, shaved head and, like, yeah, toned down, not just in, like, a gender way, but in a everything way. Fashions.
Yeah.
Like, the classic, like, non-binary fashion collection of, like, gray bags. I think that was, and to some extent still is kind of the like, dominating image.
Yeah, it's, they're, instead of being like, yes, we're going to tone it down, they're toning it up. And so everything is toned up, right? Their look is toned up, their style is toned up, all of the other elements of their band is toned up.
Yeah. Yeah, everything is kind of like, yeah, to 11. Yeah, I think a lot of their stuff is kind of, I want to say, especially when Martin Gore is singing, like, very theatrical, I think, a lot of the time.
I have a lot of feelings about Martin Gore's voice. That's actually,
I wanted to say, yeah, I think you were, when you were talking about Japan, but I might be misremembering, but yeah, like, singing along to Martin Gore and, like, trying to sing along to Dave Gahan was, like, very affirming for me in an ender way in like, high school.
Yeah. I think the thing for me that is kind of affirming about Martin Gore's voice is just in contrast to Dave Gahan's voice, right? He's got this very weirdly sweet upper range tenor voice. And, you know, Gahan has this deeper bass, baritone, kind of aggressive voice. And so the clash of the two of them also allows someone, you know, myself having a higher range, you can feel like, oh, I'm singing next to Dave Gahan instead of way above, right? It's part of the song. It fits in.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a really good point. Because I think their voices are very different. And I think a lot of their stuff, like, it just feels very good to sing along to. Like, a lot of it is, like, there's so many songs that are kind of, like, ballady. Instrumentals are sometimes kind of, not always, sometimes kind of goofy, though, and, like, always just, like, very fun. Like, I'm just thinking about, like, on, like, the whip sounds on, like, Master and Servant, which actually in the studio was somebody spitting.
Really?
Yeah. Oh, that they, God, like, messed with.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, you hear stories about them in the studio just sampling anything they can get their hands on and messing with it, right?
Yeah. Definitely. Yeah, it's very fun a lot of the time, even when it's, like, heavier. Final thoughts. Turning to, like, older bands was, like, just really helpful for me, I think, when I was figuring shit out, because it, like, feeling like there was some level of, like, precedence for what I was trying to be when I was in, like, 9th, 10th grade, when I was, like, figuring stuff out and coming out. The, like, discourse that around, like, being trans and especially, like, being non-binary that I was exposed to at the time was, like 2016 Tumblr, which was not super helpful for figuring out just, like, what felt good and, like, what I enjoyed in terms of gender expression. How I experienced it was very geared towards, like, a very, very particular, like, delineations of identity that were hard to approach. And I think having stuff that was, like, older and in no way involved in that, and like, and usually very kind of nebulously androgynous and like queer, especially in terms of gender stuff, like not explicitly any like gender non-conforming, but
yeah
it was just helpful for me. It helped me have like a sense of precedence and like a mirror for my feelings, which is just always helpful when you're a teen. It was in particular helpful with like dealing with that era of trans discourse.
Right. Yeah. I kind of want to second that. I feel like when I was trying to figure out my own gender identity, the discussions around being non-binary were still very much, not that they maybe aren't, I just am no longer figuring that out, so I'm not in those spaces, but they were very much, you should try to look like this if you want to be androgynous. If you want to pass even as a non-binary person, you need to be doing these things and acting like this and doing this and that. And that really wasn't something I was necessarily interested in. And so having different outlets to kind of discover and invent the way I was going to present and think about my gender was very helpful to me as well at the time. And I think music is a good outlet for that. Yeah, I also agree with what you said about it sets a precedent for how to kind of look and think about those things without it necessarily having to be directly genderqueer in a way that is actually weirdly in itself helpful. Like the fact that it's not maybe necessarily being labeled by those people as being genderqueer allows someone who's genderqueer to be like, okay, but that's maybe what feels good to me. And so I don't care what people are telling me I need to be doing. This is what I want to be doing.
Yeah. I think it makes a little more space to like project your own stuff onto it.
Mm-hmm. I guess also for me, being non-binary has been a very individual experience. I mean, not that I don't relate to other non-binary people, because I feel like I really do, and I'm very fortunate to have a lot of non-binary or gender non-conforming people in my life, but each person I know who's non-binary experiences and thinks about and talks about their gender in very different ways. And so having these musical influences and style influences who I could look on to be kind of my own guides in that and kind of building that myself instead of looking to other non-binary people who are my peers was pretty helpful for me, I think.
Yeah, totally. I think it was really helpful. It's very helpful to see gender being explicitly performed. I think that's part of what's helpful about, for example, like Mark Bolan was like bi, but like kind of straight, and like doesn't seem to have articulated any kind of gender stuff in his life. Mm-hmm. And so like I think getting to see gender expression where you know it's a performance because you have a kind of like an understanding of how that person, like where that person's actually coming from, or like an understanding of how they fit into like gender expectations and stuff in like their personal like non-performance life.
Mm-hmm.
It makes it more approachable to, okay, like I'm just gonna try some stuff, and it doesn't have to be tied to any like super clear understanding of what's happening with me internally, or like I don't have to like articulate anything to just try stuff out and see what is fun.
Yeah.
I think also like, cause a lot of it is, I mean like we were talking with like Depeche Mode or like with Brian Molko, like it's a lot of times it's so like kind of messy and like not coming from a place of like trying to create a super specific perception of yourself, but usually more like repeating myself, but like kind of like antagonistic, or like just wanting to dress up for the fun of dressing up kind of takes the pressure off of experimenting with your gender presentation, I think.
And
like for me opened up more space for it to be a fun thing. Which I think is productive. Like I think following what feels good is very helpful figuring out gender stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I guess that kind of to connect to something I talked about earlier, the interview with the member of Japan who was like don't feel like a man, I don't feel like a woman. And then years later, he's like, oh, but I'm like cis. That was just something I said. I'm like, but it makes me think about the presentation of the band members at that time and how it was, you know, again, something where they were performing a certain kind of gender and it was, you know, hyperbolic in a way where, again, it's not necessarily about if you feel like a man or if you feel like a woman. It's about just trying what feels good, making your hair big, cutting your hair, who cares?
Yeah. And like, it's fun and exciting to like break from how people are expecting you to present no matter what, I think, like regardless mm-hmm. of identity.
Yeah, yes, exactly.
Very powerful thing.
mm-hmm. Right, right. I think, yeah, that's another thing too, is it's like, yes, this was helpful to me as a non-binary teenager, but even if I were cis, I think it would be helpful to me just on a sheer level of understanding that gender nonconformity isn't what we're taught that it is, and it also doesn't have to be something that's only accessible to trans people.
Yeah, absolutely. Something that's available to anybody and everybody because it is fun and like enriches mm-hmm. life.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, totally. I feel like that's a good note to end on.
I agree. I agree.
Yeah.
I've been Teddy.
Yeah, I've been Elton. Thank you for having this talk with me. This was
Yes. Thank you for having this talk with me. This has been wonderful.
Yeah.